Brad Wheatless, ABC News.
This is Tony Pan. The forecast for tonight, to expect mostly cloudy skies, cool temperatures, periods of rain off and on through the night, low temperatures in the 50s. Same story on Monday, cloudy skies, cool conditions, periods of rain off and on through the day. The high temperatures only in the upper 50s and low 60s. Still a chance for a shower or thunderstorm on Tuesday, but it'll get a little warmer with highs in the upper 60s. Dry weather comes back in the forecast on Wednesday, partly sunny with a high near 72. From the WCBM Weather Center, this is Tony Pan.
Talk Radio 680, WCBM.
21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Sitting in the darkness.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. This is Dr. Bob Hieronymus, lowly PhD, hanging out somewhere in this part of the universe, and we understand it's probably Baltimore. Our executive producer and research assistant, Laura Cordner. Our engineer is Jake Bryant. Well, welcome to 21st Century Radio's 7th annual 2-hour special on the Maryland Film Festival's 11th year. Well, each and every year, the director of the Maryland Film Festival joins us to give us an overview of what's going on during its 4-day program and to cite some of its highlights. And as you know by now, the Maryland Film Festival has numerous ways for you to be able to afford attending. But one of the very best ways of signing up for the festival is the All Access Pass, which would have cost you a remarkably inexpensive $175. But, well, before the festival, however, the all-access passes have been sold out. So they didn't get a chance to charge you $250, which was what it was going to cost you on May the 6th. Now, there are many moviegoers that are well aware that that was the best affordable way to attend any and all the films you want to see. However, there are other affordable ways to see most of what you want. And joining us now is the Maryland Film Festival's director, Jed Dietz, who is responsible for the festival's growth and development, even during these perilous economic times, brought on by many billionaires of our last Republican president who, of course, one of his best friends was the Enron brothers. I call them the Enron brothers. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio, Jed.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Well, Jed, besides buying your all-access passes, which are all sold out, is this the first time that's happened?
Well, we sold out last year, too, but then we increased the number by 25% this year, and that sold out. So
wow.
We sold more this year than we sold last year before we'd even announced any programming.
Yeah, well, it's understandable. Now, is there another membership level that will grant all access to the Maryland Film Festival?
Well, like you said, there are lots of ways to buy tickets. The single tickets are easy to find on the website, mdfilmfest.com. You can buy batches of tickets all week until the festival opens, and then you have to go to the tent village.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a member of Friends of the Festival, which is a $50 to $2,000 a year membership, you get into every screening on Friday before 6 for free.
Mm-hmm.
So there are lots of ways to see films at the festival.
Well, there are other goings-ons at the film festival that are free and that can be found in the Tent Village. What goes on in the Tent Village from about May 8th to the 10th?
Well, we have a whole list of activities. This year, all of them hosted by the Maryland Film Office. And there are workshops with filmmakers. You get to see works in progress. We've got three returning filmmakers who are going to show films that they're in the midst of making right now. This year you'll get to see a short film that Matthew Modine made, and he will be here to host it. And then there are a lot of, we have a panel that the Maryland Film Office is hosting on criticism or how to get your film to market. So it's a great way for anybody interested, either as an audience member or as a filmmaker, in not only filmmaking but the marketing of films, which is a trick, a whole other level of work. And there will be people here who are, you know, very good at it and in the midst of it. So there will be lots of things to learn at the 10th Village. And that's all free, as you mentioned.
It's all
Everything
free.
There is free.
Now, two of Maryland's legendary film directors, John Waters and Barry Levinson, contribute to the film festival yearly, or nearly so.
Yeah, John's been here every year. Barry launched us with a documentary, the first documentary he'd ever made, and we had the world premiere of it at the first festival, called The Original Diner Guys, which he continues to work on. It's been at many festivals around the world, the Comedy Fest in Aspen, Tribeca, et cetera. And John's been here every year. John is on our board this year. We asked two filmmakers to go on our board this year. John is a nonfiction, is a fiction filmmaker, and Rachel Grady, who has made The Boys of Baraka and Jesus Camp, among other films, has been nominated for the Academy Award, and she's a nonfiction filmmaker. Grew up in Maryland, but lives in New York now, and she's on our board. And they've both been incredibly great contributors, both at the board level and as filmmakers.
What's John's pick this year?
Hey, he's chosen a French romantic comedy musical with threesomes and gay love, and it's sort of the anti-Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and it's a film called Love Songs, and it is built around 12 songs written by Alex Baupin. It's directed by Christophe Honoré, and it's, you know, it's got the most beautiful people in it. It's really a delight. It's a wonderful, wonderful choice.
What about Barry Levinson? Is he contributing this year as well? Isn't he?
He is. He has made a documentary. This is now his second one, both of which will have been at the festival as of next week. And this is something he's been interested in for quite a while. The film is called Pollywood, which was a term that was created by right-wing people in the country to sort of make fun of actors and artists who got involved in politics. And Barry was interested in that and went to both conventions last year, the Democratic and Republican convention, having never been to a convention before in his life. And then he went to the inauguration. And he is in the film quite a bit. He asks questions of the people participating in the process, and many of them were famous, you know, Anne Hathaway and Susan Sarandon, Ellen Burstyn, Matthew Modine, Richard Schiff, etc. But one of the things that's so interesting, and it is not a liberal or conservative film, what Barry is interested in is citizens trying to cut through this melding of media and politics that has happened. Will probably gone on since the onset of television, but is really accelerated. And he doesn't have any big solutions in this film, but he's asking questions and trying to see is this fusing of media and politics distracting us? Is it helping us? And where are we now in this process? And one of the things that's interesting is whether you are liberal or conservative, you see these, well-known people really participating in the political process. And in a way, it really underscores what a genius of a process this was that our forefathers set in motion. But it isn't perfect, and Barry's interested in things that have happened to it. The film opens, actually, with that great scene from Avalon when the television is brought into the house, which was sort of Barry's way of, in a fictional way, of documenting the first intrusion of media into our mm-hmm. culture, and the big one, the big one with television. And we're going to follow it with a panel. We're opening this up now. There's going to be a discussion afterwards. Dan Roderick's from WIPR, Barry Levinson, Matthew Modine, who is in the film, and David Brock, who is the founder and CEO of Media Matters for America, which is a website set up to sort out misinformation that floats around the press. And he's very interesting to me because he started really as a right-wing attack guy against Clarence Thomas and the Clintons, and or Anita Hill and the Clintons. And he then wrote a book that it went on to win a lot of awards and was a big seller called Blinded by the Right. And so he's been very involved in this whole world and is running one of the big websites now. So that panel should be a fascinating panel following up this movie. And I haven't even seen the finished version. I saw Barry sent me an earlier version a couple weeks ago, and I loved it. And he's been working on it since. So we'll see. We'll be seeing something that's really brand new.
Is that free?
No, that's you have to buy a ticket, but you can do that on the web, and it's a week from today, Sunday afternoon.
Well, let me mention that now. MarylandFilmFest.com, MDFilmFest.com, or call 410-752-8083, 410-752-8083. Now, the Maryland Film Festival has also been a leader in its presentation of short films. What kind of selection of shorts will be screened, and what are some of the ones that you especially care about?
Oh gosh, we'll screen 130 movies next weekend, 80 of them shorts, and they're all terrific. Bill Plimpton, the great animator, has three new films.
Three
in the festival. Our opening night shorts program has become sort of a signature for the festival. We're the only general film festival anywhere that I know of that devotes its opening night to shorts.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, last year, Barry Levinson hosted the evening. And this year, a filmmaker by the name of Bobcat Goldthwait, who is also a stand-up comedian, is hosting. And his short film, Home Movies, is in the opening night program. And it's a wide variety of films that cover every part of the movie making art form, and the shortest one I think is 3 minutes long. Bobcats is 7 minutes long. I think the longest one is 22 minutes long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a wide variety there.
Yep.
Well, what about the full length, the longer productions? Let's talk about some of them that are especially impressive to you and those who determine which films were to be screened.
Well, I'm gonna jump over the films with the filmmakers that you're gonna have on a little bit later in the program, because you'll get into them in detail. But there are I would mention just several. There's an incredible documentary by a French director named Agnès Varda, who is now 80 years old. This will probably be the last movie she will make. And it looks back on her life. She is in the movie and directs the movie. And it is full of luminaries from the film world over her 40-year career. And it's called Agnès Varda, The Beaches of Agnès. And that's really one not to miss. It's an extraordinary movie. Our guest host program this year, we have three really interesting guest hosts. Seth Goldman, who is the founder and CEO of Honest Tea, this sort of interesting company that he started several years ago with this whole new way of brewing iced tea, completely non-corporate, completely new way of doing it. And that company is now part of Coca-Cola, and they're now helping Coca-Cola get more organic in like their fruit division and that kind of stuff. But he has put together a program around a news cinematographer-producer named Ray Farkas, who is not a name that most people will know, but you will have seen lots of his work. As I said in the notes to this program, probably more people have seen each of the little films he's made for with journalists like Meredith Vieira and Steve Croft, and have seen all the documentaries we've shown in 11 years. And so that's one. Laura Lippman, the great author of the Tess Monahan series, has chosen a film called Funny Bones that I think is the only film, I think I'm safe in saying this, is the only film on the planet that brings together Oliver Platt, great independent and stage actor, Jerry Lewis, the great comedian, and Peter Chesslem, who is the has directed a bunch of movies, but is the director most famously recently of Hannah Montana, the movie. I'm pretty sure this is the only time the three of them ever worked together.
Yeah.
And then a great musician, a punk rocker named Ian MacKaye, has chosen a legendary film that I've never seen and very hard to see about Nina Simone. So those three programs are completely different and wonderful and sprinkled through the weekend. The Alloy Orchestra on Sunday morning is performing with a silent Russian film, 70-minute film called Man with a Movie Camera, which is something is a movie that means a great deal to every filmmaker because it is to this day has such incredible imagery and used documentary techniques that this guy Bertov really pioneered that are used to this day. And they have not been able to perform this score for 10 years because this is one of their most famous scores. It's on, it's on DVDs and it's been copied many times. But there hasn't been a print of the film available. And they just bought from the great archive in Russia, Gosfilma Fund, a print. So they have, Eastman has one, and now they have one. And so they're just starting to perform. Matter of fact, the first performance in over 10 years was on April 9th in St. Petersburg. And the second one will be in Baltimore next Sunday.
Are there any 3Ds? I think I saw one.
Yeah, we've got, a legendary one. We do this every year. Chris Kaltenbach from The Sun hosts a screening of one of the classic 3D films, two projector. These are projected through two projectors simultaneously. John Standiford at the Charles puts this program together and implements it, and he's really great at it. And we got a film that is often considered the greatest 3D film made in the classic period called Inferno, and it stars Robert Ryan. And as far as I know, there is one print available, and this is the print we're going to be showing.
That's incredible. You know, the thing that I know I shouldn't be worried about, but, you know, I'm always concerned some of these films are going to burn up.
Well, the shipping, the projection, all of that is, we take, a great sense of responsibility. And fortunately, this one is in very good hands, and it comes out of the Fox archives, and I can't thank them enough for trusting us with this.
Well, The Strong Man, that really looks fascinating as well. He really can bend pennies with his fingers?
Yep. You'll have to, come and see it.
So, that's tough, man.
Yeah, so it's a great one to mention because we get a lot of submissions. Hundreds and hundreds of films are submitted to us. But we also go all through the year to other festivals and, of course, are in touch all the time with the filmmakers that have already been here who point us in direction. And this one won the Grand Jury Award for Best Documentary at this year's Slamdance Film Festival, which is runs alongside Sundance in Park City, Utah. And Skiz Zizek, one of our programmers, has been very excited to get this, and we're delighted to have it and really looking forward to it.
Now, besides the films and the Maryland Film Office's discussion panel series, you guys are great for parties to kick off and to conclude at the festival. When do these generally occur, and how can our listeners attend them?
Yep. Well, we do have parties sometimes attached to screenings, like the opening night and closing night have a party after it. So that ticket comes with the party ticket. And then there are some other parties sprinkled around. The French Embassy is for people going to Love Songs, the John Waters pick. They're hosting a reception afterwards in the 10th Village. And then there are lots of things springing up, Bob, all around. I mean, the various art galleries around are having music during the weekend. It's really been wonderful to see. I mean, everybody from Wind Up Space to Metropole.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's an interesting place, the wind-up space.
Yep.
It really, I'm going to
no,
be
No, it's really, that that whole Station Arts North District is really taking off.
Oh, it's so good to see this. And thank God for Mike Schechter and all the work he's done in that particular area.
Yep.
Well, thank you for joining us, Uncle Jed, and we'll be seeing you at the festival, partying and twisting the night away.
You bet. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Okay.
And when we return, our two guests, Milton Glaser, to Inform and Delight, and that is Wendy Keys, the producer, director of that particular film, will be joining us. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Mother's Day she'll cherish. Of Talk Radio 680, WCBM.
If you're a business owner or executive seeking growth yet determined to cut wasteful costs, consider outsourcing your whole marketing department to The Selling Well. The Selling Well offers businesses truly superior marketing services without all the overhead costs associated with employing a full-time marketing executive. Learn more online at thesellingwell.com. That's thesellingwell.com, named after one of our greatest symbols of prosperity, the well. Visit thesellingwell.com or call The Selling Well's managing partner, Plato Hieronymus, at 443-939-1890, thesellingwell.com. Researchers at Johns Hopkins are seeking volunteers with a diagnosis of cancer to participate in a scientific study of self-exploration brought about by psilocybin. Psilocybin is a psychoactive substance found naturally in mushrooms, which has been used for centuries as a sacrament for religious and spiritual purposes. Volunteers will be given careful preparation before receiving the psilocybin in a comfortable, supportive setting. Structured guidance both during and after the session will facilitate integration. This study complies with all FDA regulations. Please call 410-550-5990 or visit cancer-insight.org. Confidentiality will be maintained. That's 410-550-5990 or www.cancer-insight.org.
Hello, this is Richard Taylor down in Wellington, New Zealand. We looked after the special makeup effects, armor weapons, creatures and miniatures for Lord of the Rings. And I'm here with 21st Century Radio and my good friend Bob Hieronymus way up there in America.
Yeah, indeed. It's been a long time since we got together with Richard and look forward to it again. Well, sometimes the truth needs to be told, and here's my confession number 735. And there are periods in my life when I have to escape, and when I do, it's for brief excursions into New York City. It's there at the School for Visual Arts that refreshes my inspiration to so-called fight the good fight. And usually we go up the third week of October, and it has become the time for me to flee. And began when my very dear friend Heinz Edelman was honored in 2005 as one of their Master Series artists. In 2006, the Visual Arts Foundation honored Jules Feiffer, and you can imagine the joy it was to spend just a few minutes with him. And likewise, in 2007 with Stephen Heller, and in 2008, April. Boy, do we have a good time with April Grineman, whose awareness of the work of Dr. Carl Jung and the collective unconscious was music to my ears. Well, while venturing into my old stomping grounds of New York City and spending time at the School for Visual Arts and presenting my work at the Beatles' Yellow Submarine to Gene Stavis' film classes, I couldn't avoid seeing the legendary figure whose work continues to inspire generations of artists. And it was Heinz Edelman, the father of Yellow Submarine art, whose deep admiration for Milton Glaser inspired me to look again at his Milton Glaser's lifetime accomplishments. And joining us this segment is Wendy Keys, the director and producer of perhaps one of the best biographies on any artist that I've ever seen. And perhaps maybe even been attempted. But of course, I've only seen 33,000 films. As well as this film is called To Inform and Delight. And here's a little bio of Wendy. Since 1966, Wendy Keyes has held important positions as both administrator and programmer at the Film Society of Lincoln Center, and until 1999, she was the executive producer programming for the Film Society and a member of selection committees of the New York Film Festival and New Directors, New Films, an annual series co-sponsored with the Museum of Modern Art. In 72 to 2008, she directed and co-produced the Film Society's annual gala tribute to a major film artist, sometimes aired live on PBS as part of Live from Lincoln Center. Ms. Keyes has also been instrumental in several outreach programs bringing filmmakers to students and in support of Human Rights Watch. And to many, Milton Glaser is the embodiment of American graphic design during the latter half of the 20th century. From newspapers and magazine designs to interior spaces, logos, brand identities, to his celebrated prints, drawings, posters, and paintings, his impact on the profession internationally has been formidable. He co-founded the revolutionary Pushpin Studios in 1954, founded New York Magazine in 1968, and throughout his career has had one-man shows in Paris and the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Glaser's renowned graphic and architectural designs range from the iconic I Love New York logo to complete graphic and decorative programs for restaurants in the World Trade Center. It sounds like I've just read the Declaration of Independence, friends, but I wanted to make sure you understood who was joining us tonight. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio, Milton.
Hi, I'm completely exhausted.
Well, so am I. And it's Sunday night on top of that, yeah. I don't know if you're aware of it, but you joined us 10 years ago to discuss your important input into the Yellow Submarine film, which is just about one billionth of your contribution to making our planet a better place. And Wendy, thank you for joining us as well. I really enjoyed this documentary. I learned so much.
I'm so pleased to hear it. Thank you.
Wendy, you've known Milton since the early 70s and have done so much more for the film world. Why did you decide that he should be the first film you wanted to direct and produce?
Well, I was actually attending an event at Checkerboard Film Foundation, and before the event began, they had a film. They had a slideshow showing the films that they had made, most of which were artists, a few architects, a poet, and I thought, you know, really, they should have a designer up here, and if they had a designer, it should be Milton Glaser. And if they're going to make a film on Milton Glaser, I want to make that film on Milton Glaser. So with the idea in hand, I went to Milton. He was interested. He said, in typical Milton fashion, that, you know, we should learn how to do this together. And it was, you know, at this late stage of my film career, you know, a big eye-opener. I had many, many lessons to learn. And it just once I had the idea, there was no turning back.
Well, there were others that assisted you on this 4 to 5 year project. That's a lot of time. Who were they?
Well, I had a wonderful film crew, and even though at the beginning, because I'd seen so many documentaries, I decided that I was not going to, you know, use the typical cliches of talking heads and baby pictures and voiceovers and things. But, you know, once I realized that there were things that Milton couldn't really say about himself, then I realized that I had to sort of bring in some other people to say those things that he couldn't really say. So I, you know, Steve Heller, who you mentioned earlier, Katrina Vandenhoevel, Ralph Kaplan, Brookie Maxwell, there were Peter Mayer, there was Jivan Tabibian, a friend in Vienna. There were a lot of people who had very original, different perspectives to bring to the subject. Worked well.
Well, I just can't tell you how much I enjoyed this. Milton, I understand that you've been searching for a definition of what art is, and you came upon Horace's, I think it was around 1st century BC, his idea of its purpose that actually became the title for this film. Tell us about that, please.
Well, I was looking all my life. I've been stumbling around trying to find an adequate explanation of art or its purpose or what it does to us or anything else relating to the subject, which is always clothed in obscurity and mystery. And I finally came to the conclusion that it is really a state of being very much like meditation. What I mean by that is when you meditate, you basically look at the world without prejudging it. And as a consequence, you can actually see it for the first time, because as we know, what you believe the world is, it becomes for us. So I thought that idea, that if you think of the art experience, which is in some profound way related to the idea of human survival, then what makes sense is that art creates a state of mind that enables you to be attentive in the same way that meditation does. Because it seemed clear to me that attentiveness itself was one thing we could say aided human survival. So that's the beginning of this field theory. I'm sure it's been said other ways, but it cleared up a profound mystery to me about art's purpose. Most of the time, we don't have a sense of what its purpose is. And as a result of that, we understand mostly that it is something about beauty. But what I deduced was that beauty was merely the mechanism, because humans are susceptible to beauty, that made you pay attention. In short, beauty was what made you attentive. Anyhow, that's a kind of condensed version of where I'm going with all of this, but it seems to make sense to me.
Well, you also support the idea that art's great contribution, or possibly greatest contribution, is creating commonalities that are providing common ground. Why might that be essential?
Well, the one thing we know is that if people are left to their own devices and feel that they are surrounded with others, this idea of the self, the community, and the other seems to be profound in human experience. But the greater the psychic and physical distance of others, the less you care about them. So much so that once you categorize someone else as being other, you're perfectly willing to kill them. However, what art does is it produces what you just mentioned, the word commonality. It means that if I like Mozart and you like Mozart, we already have something in common and consequently are less likely to kill one another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a terrific insight, Milton. I really do. Now, from your early days, you've wanted people to see your work in public places, not just galleries and museums. Why was this so important to you?
Well, it's an interesting and very complex idea, probably because I was born at the beginning of our Depression, and the idea of earning a living as opposed to seeking self-expression was the most important thing in my life. And it wasn't that I couldn't imagine earning a living other ways, but the idea of doing a painting and putting it in the gallery and having somebody buy it and put it above their couch was completely incomprehensible to me. The other thing I knew was that I wanted to be in public life, that I wanted to have my work seen and experienced by a general public rather than a few collectors. And I never could understand the fundamental idea of doing the work and selling the work and the work fundamentally not being seen, except if you happen to be one of those rare personalities who is so brilliant and so distinctive in your perception and so lucky that you stumble into visibility and become famous and then are shown in museums and in books and so on. But it seemed to me that unless you had the ability of Picasso or Pierre Del Francesco or Matisse, it was a very unlikely possibility. So I thought it would be better to play in a smaller pond, which is the world of applied design and the world of anything that is done with a purpose in mind. And that suited me better. But in terms of the definition that I just gave you, the question of whether something is art or is not art becomes much more complex.
Well, in regards to that, you also adhere to the belief that art is defined generationally and that it is the institutionalization of a belief like style or taste that limits it. Could you elaborate a little bit on that, please?
Well, the great thing that art does is that it changes your perception of reality. I mean, if art has any purpose, it's to shift the way you see things. The case I most often cite is in drawing, and the book I've just done is called Drawing is Thinking, because I was sitting at the dining table with my mother. I was about 18, and I decided that I would draw a portrait. I'd never done that. But in looking at her carefully with the idea that I was going to draw her, the shift of mind occurs when you are about to draw something, which makes you attentive, and so you look at something for the first time. And when I looked at her, I realized I had absolutely no idea of what she looked like, that whatever my perception was about her appearance, it had been formed early in my childhood and had never changed from that time, even though she had dramatically. And then I realized that it was this belief in what she looked like that I held in my mind that prevented me from seeing her. And I presume that that applies to everything, which is to say that when you look at something with the idea of recreating it or drawing it, you have to examine it fully for the first time. And in doing that, you'll notice the way light passes across the face, or the curve of an arm, or the wrinkle on the forehead, or whatever else it is that you ignore in daily life. So it is this shift into an attentive state to look at something without preconception. Preconceptions kill you because they prevent you fundamentally from experiencing any reality. Reality is so adaptive to our needs and so mutable that it will change fundamentally, instantly, when the mind experiences any reality with a preconceived idea of what it is.
Wendy, Walter Bernard, the first art director for New York Magazine, says that Milton invented service journalism. What did he mean by service journalism?
Walter was a very good spokesman for that because, as you may know, Walter and Milton do work together on design for magazines and newspapers to this day. But he was talking about the fact that that these magazines were directed for the consumers, not at the consumers. So they were there to help the consumer, in this case, New York City in the 70s during a difficult period of the city, and helping them get through their problems with finding appropriate apartments, finding inexpensive places to eat, and letting them know where the underground parties were, letting them know how to really improve their experience, their day-to-day experience of living in the city. And of course, this idea, which is what Milton really put forth, I think Clay Felker probably did the more political editorials and things, but editorial stories. But then this idea of service journalism went through first the country and then the world to help people maneuver their way through their daily experiences in a much more fulfilling way. And I think that's really one of the most invaluable contributions that Milton has made to our culture.
I'll say, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that after we get back, because I understand that it was in regards to service journalism, Milton's involvement in supermarket design, which gave him the fundamentalistic conception as to how to communicate clearly. Whoa, we're going to touch on that when we get back, because one of Milton's students, Deborah Adler, achieved an incredible thing in regards to Fox Television, which we'll talk about when we return with our guest Wendy Keyes and Milton Glaser. Milton Glaser, To Inform and Delight, directed by Wendy Keyes, one of the films selected for the 2009 Maryland Film Festival, May 7th through 10th. You can go to arthousefilmsonline.com or Milton Glaser, spelled GLASER.com, MiltonGlaser.com, or ArthousefilmsOnline.com.
Prepare your winter skin. in for warmer weather.
On Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Do surgeons believe in divine intervention? This week we hear from a brain surgeon who says, yes, all doctors are all working with universal life force and energy, whether they know it or not. Sunday night at 8, 21st Century Radio, Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Zoe Hieronymus here. Do you ever wonder how biblical women dealt with stress? They experienced famine, war, lack of water, shortage of shelter, and inequality in their culture overall. But somehow, the seven prophetesses of Israel all rose to great leadership as a warrior, midwife, judge, royal queen, and more. Find out how you can be a queen. Kabbalah gives us all the tools for becoming the most we can be. Learn how to create peace in your life and love of others in your heart. Read my book, The Kabbalistic Teachings of the Female Prophets, the Seven Holy Women of Ancient Israel. Visit www.sevenholywomen.com. That's www.sevenholywomen.com, or visit amazon.com to get my book, The Kabbalistic Teachings of the Female Prophets.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio's Hieronymus and Company, where knowledge comes first. And now, here's something I hope you really like.
If you look at any of his recent work, he's increasingly thinking about world issues and wants to design in a way that can help the causes that he's interested in.
What he brings to this conversation is more than idealism. It's true eloquence. It's more than a doctrinaire philosophy. It's a humanist philosophy.
Starting 4 or 5 years ago, I realized I didn't have the right to be indifferent or to ignore what was going on. And since I have some talent for communicating ideas, I thought I might use that talent or else feel like a real jerk for the rest of my life.
Boy, what an understatement. Some talent there, huh? Well, welcome back to 21st Century Radio, and that was Milton Glaser. As a matter of fact, the film that you should be seeing at the Maryland Film Festival is Milton Glaser, To Inform and Delight. It's directed by Wendy Keyes, one of the films selected for the 2009 Maryland Film Festival, May 7th through 10th. And, of course, the websites to check out are arthousefilmsonline.com and miltonglaser.com, G-L-A-S-E-R.com, miltonglaser.com. Okay, now, in regards, Milton, in regards to service journalism, it was your involvement in the supermarket design which gave you the fundamentalistic conception of how to communicate clearly. Would you please explain this?
Well, what I was interested in about the supermarket, it's where everybody is. And the entire country shares that experience, going to the supermarket. And the first thing I looked at when I was asked by Sir James Goldsmith to design his supermarkets, which was a company named Grand Union, was what I had learned from the magazine business that helped me understand what people needed when they went into the supermarket. One of the principles of supermarket design used to be that keep the public confused about where they were going. Don't tell them too clearly where anything was, so that their path through the supermarket would force them to pass all kinds of other things that they were not looking for. That seemed like good marketing, but it seemed to me to be not only indifferent, but cynical about what you wanted to do with your customers, who, after all, were supporting you. The first thing I decided just came from the simple observation that when you help people and they found the supermarket experience more pleasant, they would tend to come back more frequently and they would buy more each time because they had some affection for the market. So it seemed reasonable to me and quite the opposite of the convention of supermarket appearance and aisles and everything else, that the most important thing you could do with somebody in a supermarket was to make them feel comfortable about being there. Mm-hmm. And so I changed some of the basic assumptions of the structure of the market. I opened up the aisles because that unlimited sort of constriction it's extremely tedious when you go through aisle after aisle with no space. In addition to that, I changed the lighting systems because lighting variety fights fatigue. If you have those dreadful standard lights beaming down at you at 1,000 watts at every level in the market, you become exhausted before you go 10 or 20 feet. So what I did was I lowered the ceiling at certain parts. I changed the nature of the lights. I went from incandescent to fluorescent so that the light was variable and so that when you finished an area of a supermarket, the shift in light virtually announced you are now leaving one part of the supermarket and entering another. It was obvious that undifferentiated light and space was the one thing that people would get most tired of while they were shopping. And it turned out to be true. And the supermarket, Grand Union, moved from the bottom of the list as most preferable supermarket. It was next to last to next to first within the course of 2 or 3 years, showing that people really appreciated the fact that people cared about their comfort and were not merely interested in maximizing their sales. Not that the supermarket was not concerned about maximizing sales, but not at the expense of the comfort of the visitor. Mm-hmm. So that seemed to me that it was merely a series of logical steps. In this case, my desire to make people feel better ended up being an enormous virtue for the market itself. People liked it.
Well, no wonder they liked it, you know. Well, one of Milton's students, Wendy, I think her name was Deborah Adler, repackaged the designs for prescriptions that has now become the paradigm of the entire field. How did this come about?
Oh, Deborah has a wonderful story. It's a personal story about her grandparents taking the same drug with different dosage. And one day her grandmother took her grandfather's drug by mistake because the drug bottles look very, very similar. And nothing terrible happened, but she did get dizzy, and she realized, Deborah realized, that something really should be done about differentiating the different the medical bottles within a family. So she went she set herself to the task of redesigning the bottle, the simple matter of just putting a different colored band on the top of it to differentiate which one is her grandfather's and which one is her grandmother's was taken care of. She also flattened the cylinder so that you can read more easily what it is, what the dosage is, and who it's for, and on the back the instructions as to what the what the problems might be in certain cases. So all the information was very clearly set forth in a different shaped bottle. Milton had worked with Target before and had pitched it to them. They liked the idea. They developed it. It became a huge thing, not only for Deborah, but for Target. She's adorable, for one thing. She was featured in their ads. She's very articulate. She was able to talk about how this personal experience that her grandparents had was inspiration for her to turn a product from something that we all live with into something much more enlightened, much more useful, and she sort of made design history with this. Won awards at the annual design fairs and everything. So it was a terrific, terrific story.
Well, it certainly is. I mean, it's one of the best examples of service journalism I've ever heard, in which an artist actually can change an industry in a very positive way instead of giving up on it. And Milton, you gave New York a motto that changed the way New Yorkers felt about their city. That appeared to be dying in the early 70s, and that was I Love New York, and you made a whole bunch of money off of that, didn't you?
No. In fact, I made no money off of it. But I was rewarded in a much more profound way, which was that it really was one of the instrumentalities that helped turn the city around at the time. As you say, in the mid-70s, everybody was moving out. The city was in terrible shape. And the Commerce Department wanted to have a campaign basically to impress foreign visitors that it was worthwhile coming to New York, which had become dirty and dangerous, where the people themselves had sort of lost faith in the city. And what was needed was a kind of, I suppose one could call it, morale-boosting attempt to make people feel good about being here.
Well, with that, we have to pause here at the top of the hour. When we return, we'll finish with that and find out how Italy changed Milton Friedman's, Milton Glaser's view on food, on the importance of food, and which brought about the birth of Underground Gourmet. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Wendy Keys and Milton Glaser in Milton Glaser to Inform and Delight.
Talk on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.